Those old sayings are often true, aren't they? And the one that says you can't judge a book by its cover is true. You can't judge the value of something by the packaging it comes in. And of all people, Christians should understand this. I mean, we have the parables in Matthew 13 about the valuable treasure found in the soil of a field, in the dirt of the field. And then there's also the little parable about the precious pearl found in an ugly oyster. I mean, one of the most ugly animals or creation there is. And yet inside the oyster is a beautiful pearl. Great value can be hidden in something of great value. And that's why this verse, although we're in Isaiah 41, this verse is very important. 2 Corinthians 4, verse 7. But we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that this all-surpassing power is from God and not from us. And if you want to know what that treasure is, you've got to go back to the previous verse, the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ. So, Christian, that's what you are. You are a jar of clay. You are like an earthenware pot. And I suppose if we really wanted to be cruel, you are indeed potty. Many of us have had that theory about many of us for a long time, but now the fact has been revealed. Here it is. We're potty. Clay jars, by the way, were the throwaway containers of the ancient world. Their lifespan was generally a few years at the most. You went to the well, so you took your jar with you, your clay jar with you. You went to the equivalent of Tesco's for your oil or for your grain, well, you took your jar with you. It's a wee bit like the Farm Fresh box. You know, you get the box with the your vegetables and your fruit in it, and it looks all very nice in the box. The box about that size, and it's cost you about £35. You know that kind of scene? It's like the blue and white Tesco's bag, or probably better still, it's the M&S reusable 10p bag, which you're supposed to take back and use again and again. And of course, we're into recycling, aren't we? We should certainly do that. Clay jars were the anonymous part of everyday living, used for transportation, cooking, eating, drinking, storing leftovers. Immensely important. But you really didn't take much notice of them. You took no more notice of them than you would of a fast food container. I mean, what would you do when you get your Chinese? Do you ever think, oh, I must keep that little container? Yes. Yeah, you women. Well, okay, the plastic ones you do maybe keep, but not those other things, those other tin things. I should have thought that through a wee bit more, shouldn't I? Okay, but even if we keep them, we still don't think about them very much, do we? Until the next time we're going to use them. They're simply there for convenience, aren't they? Clay jars, just like fast food containers. And there's no great tragedy when such vessels were broken. They were cheap and they were easily replaced. And that's how the Bible sees us. Clay jars. And that's how the world sees us. Unimportant, cheap and nasty, no great value. So here we have, in one subject at least, some agreement between what the Bible says and what the world says. However, what the Bible goes on to say, that within the cheap and unimportant clay jar is a treasure that is immense. The world sees a cheap container with nothing inside. The Bible sees a cheap container that's of great value, because of the treasure that is within us. And this treasured content, of course, is the good news of Jesus. Rubbish and nonsense and tripe to the world, but to God, the most important treasure. And we may be jars of clay tonight, but we have an immense treasure within us. At the center of the treasure is the cross of Jesus Christ. I don't know about you, but many times I ask the question, why can't they see it the way we do? Why can't the unsaved see the cross the way we do? And the answer, of course, to that question is that they don't look at it the way we do. And if you don't look at the thing in the right way, you'll not see the right answer. The gospel is the opposite to the world's view of power and influence. And the cross, of course, is illogical to the world and to the thinking of the world. The cross declares loudly and clearly to faithful eyes and ears and souls that weakness is in fact power, loss is gain, servanthood is greatness, and most importantly, it shows us that death is life. That's what the cross says. And the world looks at that and says, what nonsense. We look at the cross and we see, what wisdom. Jesus suffered unspeakably to show us that he loved us absolutely. And he died so that we might not only hear the truth, we might see the truth, and that we might experience the truth. And as jars of clay, we carry this treasure, we carry this message to the world that ignores it and ridicules it. And of course, the world has always treated the prophets like that. Most of the prophets were opposed and ridiculed. Some were even killed. And Isaiah, of course, was just like that. He was ridiculed and opposed. But he was a jar of clay with a glorious message. And we continue to look at that message. He presents truth. Truth that Lucas mentioned, truth that gives us certainty in uncertain days. And what kind of truth? Well, we've been learning over and over again that God is the creator of all, that God is working in time and making history. History, of course, as we all know and we've heard so many times, is his story. He is revealing his story, and we're seeing that. And we're also learning that God will one day pull the plug on time. The curtain will fall, the end will come, and the whole sorry mess that we have made will be sorted out in an instant. So what we see in Isaiah's writings, basically grace and truth. Absolute truth about all things, and kind grace as he reasons with us. And he seeks to persuade us. That's what I like about Isaiah, is that he takes time. He encourages us to think. He encourages us to respond. He longs to equip us with a decisive faith in a sad and empty world where there's so many questions and no answers, a world that's full of confusion and chaos and collapse. He longs to give us a faith that works. And if you stick with Isaiah and listen to what he's got to say, then I can tell you, you will have that kind of faith, a strong faith, a faith that will stand in evil days. In our passage tonight, this pleading presentation of truth continues. And we've got really two main headings, as you'll probably see from your little outline. I rule over history, says God, and I rule over my people. I rule over history, and I rule over my people. Let's think of verses 1 to 8. I rule over history. And first of all, let's see his involvement in time and in history. The involvement of God in time and history. Let's read through to verse 4 again. Be silent before me, you islands. Let the nations renew their strength. Let them come forward and speak. Let us meet together at the place of judgment. Who has stirred up one from the east, calling him in righteousness to his service? He hands nations over to him, and he subdues kings before him. He turns them to dust with a sword, to wind-blown chaff with his bow. He pursues them and moves on unscathed by a path his feet has not traveled before. Who has done this and carried it through, calling forth the generations from the beginning? I, the Lord, with the first of them, and with the last, I am he. Now, verse 1 you'll see there's a courtroom scene. And what God does here is he summons his own people, and he summons the nations of the world to join him. And he's a judge, and he invites the people to speak graciously. That's what he does. He wants us to enter into a dialogue. He wants the people to listen and to learn and to experience. He is determined that people make up their minds, but he wants them to make up their minds in an educated way. And look what he wants them all to have in verse 1 there. Let the nations renew their strength. If you're here last week, you'll notice that that's right at the end of chapter 40. His own people, verse 31. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. Now he tells us in chapter 41 that he wants everybody to have renewed strength. You see, the good news of God is not for the select few. not for, you know, the elite. It's for the whole world. Be silent before me, you islands. Let the nations renew their strength. God's people are to come from every tongue and tribe, a real multi-ethnic community, saved by Christ, indwelt by his Spirit. If you want to know more about that, go to Ephesians chapter 2, verse 11 through to chapter 3 and verse 12. And God wants all his people to know he is in control of history. And how does he do it? Well, he proves it by prophesying what will happen over 100 years later, naming the very man who will do that particular work. More about the naming of the man future in a future service, in a future sermon. We now know that all that is prophesied here in chapter 41 happened, just as Isaiah predicted. And you've got to look carefully at verse 2 to see what Isaiah is saying. Who has stirred up one from the east? Now, who is this one from the east? Does anybody know who this one from the east actually is? Cyrus, yeah. Cyrus became God's tool for getting his people back from exile in Babylon into their own land. Babylon took the people into captivity. Cyrus defeated Babylon and set the people free. He did that in 539 BC. He liberated the captive people, sent them all home, including the Jews. And the Jews, of course, went home, rebuilt Jerusalem, the city, and the temple. Crucial time of history. And Cyrus was a non-believing emperor that God used as his tool. So God predicts through Isaiah, way in advance of the exile, even before the exile has begun, by the way, let alone at the end of the exile, that he will employ this guy called Cyrus to get his people back where they belonged and where he promised they would be. Now, Cyrus may be the tool, but who holds the tool? Because a tool's no good on its own. It has to be held by somebody in power. Who is the craftsman? Who is in control? Well, we've got a wee clue in that in verse 4. Who has done this and carried it through, calling forth the generations from the beginning? I, the Lord, with the first of them and with the last, I am he. You see, it's God who's in control of it all. Control of the very fact that the people were taken into exile, control during the time when the people were in exile, and in control at the end of the exile when he brought them back home again, using Cyrus as his tool. The hand of God is at the helm of time. This is a lesson we must learn if we are going to make sense of living in a dark, fallen, hurting world. God is holding the helm of time. He is the first and he is the last. And when he created the universe, when he launched time, and remember last time we said that he is not controlled by time, but he began it, he set it forth. When he did that, he just didn't let it all go. He just didn't, you know, say, okay, start it off, and you people, you just get on with it and do it any way you like. No, he did not lose control. He kept control. And there he is in verse 4, the end of it, saying that he is the first cause and he will be the last effects. The first cause and the last effect. And everything in between is under his control. Cyrus, you know, just didn't turn up by chance. And Cyrus just didn't decide off his own whim, yo, I will set the people free and let them go back to Jerusalem. What nonsense. Emperors didn't do that in those days. God decided, my people will go home. And I'm going to get a guy called Cyrus to set them free and send them home. Neither the power nor the works of Cyrus was by chance, and neither is your life a fluke. Do you really believe that you're just a product of chance? See, every event in time and every event in your life is under the control of him who is the first and the last. That doesn't mean, by the way, he's pleased with every decision you make. Because some of you have made awful decisions, and you're paying the consequences, but he's still in control of those decisions. He is sovereign. He's in control. And God says, I am the first and I am the last. And that's how important you are to me, because I am going to be involved in your life. By the way, who else used that description, I am the first and the last? Jesus. Every funeral service that's read out, do not be afraid, I am the first and the last. I am the living one. I was dead, and behold, I am alive forever and ever, and I hold the keys of death and Hades. Jesus. Book of Revelation, chapter 1. You see, Jesus. This is where we see Jesus in every page of the Old Testament. And many times have we said that in these studies in Isaiah? Jesus. 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 Why? Because it's all about him. He is intensely and completely and continually involved in history. And here he is. Jesus, God, speaking, I, the Lord, with the first of them and with the last. I am he. And what God is trying to say to us is this. People, put your thinking caps on. Even just for a moment or two. Think this through. Who else could do such a thing? Who else could do this kind of activity? Who else could foretell that someone would come along and set you free and send you back so you could build your city again and build your temple and continue to try and seek me, and therefore from that line Jesus would come. I will prove my power. This is what will happen. I will make it happen because I am the first and the last. Who else could do such a thing? Who else could tell us that a Savior called Jesus would come and die and rise again and provide salvation 1,000 years plus beforehand and then do it? Who else could do it? Nobody else could do it except God, because he is the first and he is the last. He's in control of everything. And one day we will get down on our knees before him, every single one of us, and say, you are the first, you are the last, and everything you said in the book was true. Dear, help us if at that time we're not saved. But as Cyrus appears, and he's in verse 2 and 3 there, we see him, you know, sweeping through the nations, you know, taking one at a time, you know, just almost like Hitler in 1939, just one nation after another, just going through the nations, going from strength to strength. How do the nations respond? You know, that's the big question. How do they respond? God moves in history. He tells these people what he's going to do, and then he does it. How do they respond? Do you think they believe him? Do you think they will bow down before the real God who's in control of it all? Oh, not on your life. How do they respond? They retreat again to the idols. And that's what we see here in verses 5 to 7, the idolatry of man in response to the involvement of God in time. Verse 5, the islands have seen it and fear. The ends of the earth tremble. They approach and come forward. Each helps the other and says to his brother, be strong. The craftsman encourages the goldsmith, and he who smooths with the hammer spurs on him who strikes the anvil. He says of the welding, it is good. He kneels down the idol so that it will not topple. The peoples are blind, they are stubborn, and they are stupid. God works and moves for all to see, and the people hate it. This is again what we see, isn't it, time and time again. God works, God moves, God says, I'm going to do this. He does it, he proves himself again and again, and the people should respond by getting down on their knees. But what do? Instead, they hate it. And they will pick up any idol, they will create any idol, rather than bow before the majesty of God. Why? Because his holy presence disturbs them. And they will create and develop their man-made ideologies, their philosophies, their myths, their beliefs, all of man, inspired and encouraged by Satan. It's all impotent, useless, it's a waste of time. And here we have again in verse 7, the sarcasm, you know, it is good. He says of the welding, it is good. Where else do we hear? I'm asking a lot of questions tonight, just to see if the heat has caused us to sleep. Where else do we hear those words, it is good? Genesis chapter 1. You see, Isaiah saying, is it good? He kneels down the idol so it will not topple. That's how good it is. You see, if we don't delight in him, we will find delight in other things of our own making. We will build our idols, we will have to feed them, pay loads of money to keep them, but ultimately they end up leaving us empty and dissatisfied and in danger of hell. I came across a long account of a girl and her search for her idols. This is how she put it, a girl called Anne. Mostly I've tried staying very busy. That was her idol. Working too hard, trying to achieve as much as possible. You can often avoid the pain of living without God by trying to fix other people. Trying to fix other people. Shopping helps in the pinch, as does romantic obsession. Martyrdom can't be beat. While too much exercise works for many people, it doesn't for me. But I have found that a stack of magazines can be numbing and even mood-altering. And she goes on to explain her how she tries to put things right. This idol, this bit, that bit, the other bit. And it never works. God works for all to see, but man hates this and prefers his impotent and useless idols. It's idolatry. I rule over history, and he proves it. But people don't want to see the truth. Secondly, I rule over my people. This is really 8 through to 20. And really what God is saying here again and again is, I want you to see how great I am, and that from me you can draw strength and power and might. And we see the loving language of God here again. In verse 8 there, for instance, he talks about the people being chosen. My friend, he uses. Verse 9, I called you. You know, there's a language of commitment and love. But you see, in living in this world in which we have to, there's always fear close to us. Fear is one of the biggest enemies of mankind. And there's so much we could say about these verses, but we really concentrate on verse 10 there, because this is an important verse. He says, I want to inspire you with the truth about this thing called fear. Do not fear, for I am with you. Do not be dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you and help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. And we have really here five pillars of fearlessness. For I am with you, says God. Do not fear, for I am with you. For I am your God. Do not be dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. I will help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. And restated, of course, these five pillars of fearlessness are: God is with me, God is my God, God will strengthen me, God will help me, God will uphold me. So, when we go to do evangelism one-to-one, we need not fear. Some of our young people are ready to sit down to do exams or tests. Lucas, God willing, is going to have an interview or two in the next month. Maybe some of you are in the same position. Maybe you've got to take a stand against some unjust business practice. Maybe you've got to confront sin in the life of someone in your family or close family connections we thought about this morning. Some of you maybe are being called to leave a secure position and take a risk in a new venture. Maybe some of you have to face an operation or treatment, or you're going to lose a spouse or a friend or a loved one. And any or even a combination of these things will just drive you crazy with fear. But you see, when God tells us not to fear, he just doesn't leave us there hanging, you know. Do not be afraid. Do not fear. He just doesn't leave us hanging there. He gives us pillars on which to build a fearless faith. And that's the nature of all biblical commands. They come with divine support. So he says to us, fear not. Why? Because God is with you. Fear not. Why? Because God is your God. Fear not. Why? Because God will strengthen you. Fear not. Why? Because God will help you. Fear not. Tell me why. Because God will uphold you. There it is in verse 10. There's a verse for you to write out and stick on your mirror. It's one of those quotable verses. It's a verse we should remember. And Isaiah really is heaping reason on top of reason for us to live right out loud and confidently for God. His inspiration, do not fear. And then he speaks about us being his instrument. And that's what we are, his instrument. Verse 14 through to 16. And notice he calls us worm there. Do not be afraid, O worm Jacob, O little Israel. For I myself will help you, declares the Lord, your Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. See, I will make you into a threshing sledge, new and sharp with many teeth. You will thresh the mountains and crush them and reduce the hills to chaff. You will winnow them, the wind will pick them up, and the gale will blow them away. But you will rejoice in the Lord and glory in the Holy One of Israel. Now, when you come to a verse of cat or a couple of verses ago, you will think, what is he talking about? Worms and threshing sledges. Wow. Well, what he's really saying is that he's going to transform the weak to be strong. And he takes a worm. I mean, can you get something less powerful? A wriggly little worm? He's going to take a worm and make it into a brand new thresher. And the thresher is going to flatten the mountains. And all that is in between. So God is talking here about the gospel of human weakness triumphing over opposition, our timid faith overcoming the world. He's saying, you are like a little worm, but I will make you mighty. I will make you mighty so that you will thresh the mountains and crush them and reduce the hills to chaff. I think this is so encouraging. Because when we think about what we have to face as a congregation, as to reach this village and community in which we are placed, you know, we feel like worms, don't we? And God says, yeah, you are a worm, but I will make you into a mighty threshing machine. When you look at the average Christian, when you look at the average church, you wonder how we can achieve anything. And yes, we are jars of clay, but we have his power within us. And our call is to be available to and for him. And in his strength, and in his strength alone, our privilege is to thresh into smithereens every obstacle to God. And that's what he calls us to be, available and ready to go, to be his instruments, to act in his power. I rule over my people. I will inspire them. And I will use them. Isn't that mighty? And finally, his intervention, verse 17 through to 20. The picture here is of divine provision, spiritual refreshment. And we see here words of dryness and need for shelter. Let's read them again. The poor and needy search for water, but there is none. Their tongues are parched with thirst, but I, the Lord, will answer them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them. I will make rivers flow on barren heights and springs within the valleys. I will turn the desert into pools of water and the parched ground into springs. I will put in the desert the cedar and the acacia, the myrtle and the olive. I will set pines in the wasteland, the fir and cypress together. Why? So that people may see and know, may consider and understand that the hand of the Lord has done this, that the Holy One of Israel has created it. And the picture there is, again, of divine refreshment coming as God intervenes in our life. We tend to be dry too often, and we tend to be dry too much. That's what verse 17, no water, tongues are parched. But he supplies the living water that we need. The need is met by God and by God only. And we're not just talking here about morning dew or a light drizzle, but rivers and fountains and pools and springs. Water and shade are the two great needs of any desert traveler. And hence the provision of trees of shade in verse 19. Protection. And really what we're saying is, what Isaiah is saying here is that God gives what we need creatively and generously. He gives us exactly what we need. Why? What is the purpose of all this? Well, there it is in verse 20. So that the people may see and know, may consider and understand that the hand of the Lord has done this, that the Holy One of Israel has created it. You see, we get the mercy, but God gets the glory. We get the mercy, but God gets the glory. And God is sending a very clear message to everyone. He says, I want you to see it, and I want you to understand it, and I want you to believe it. I rule over history. And I'm not to be feared or dreaded. No, I rule over my people, and I will call them, and I will choose them because they're important to me. I will transform them from weak worms into strong and mighty earth movers. They will be used by me. I will take care of them, providing all they need. They will receive life from me. You see, we need him, and we can have him. And I suppose the key to it all is verse 20, so that people may see and know, may consider and understand that the hand of the Lord has done this, that the Holy One of Israel has created it. You see, we serve his purpose by enjoying his provision in the sight of the nations. We bring glory to him when we are seen to know him and receive from him power and provision. That is our best witness. If we act as if we're just doing ministry in our own power, the people will just say to us, nice effort, but I can get better. I can get better at the golf club. I can get better in the pub. You see, we've got to seek his outpouring, embrace this fullness, and experience God so that we are changed from being worms and into mighty threshing machines. See, the best witness in a truth-denying world is not smart arguments, but evidence of the presence of God. That's what people need to see in us, the presence of God. And may he sovereignly uphold us and strengthen us and refresh us. Spirituality is more than just seeing what our physical eyes can see and thinking more than what our minds, our natural minds can think, or going where we think we ought to go and do what we think we ought to do. If that's the limit of our experience, no wonder we cannot live boldly for God. If it's just a matter of seeing with our physical eyes and thinking with our natural minds, no wonder we cannot live boldly for God. But what Isaiah says, seek him and receive him and fill your life with meaning and make a difference for his glory. You are a clay jar, but he is within you. And that's what makes it exciting. Let's pray.